Hello, everyone. My name is Rich. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And I'm about to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. I'm dressed how I like to dress. I don't know if there was a dress code. So I apologize. I did not have my calendar go off. Chris called me about, 30 minutes ago? And I was like, I'm on my way now. So a little bit flustered, but I'm going to get this going. Again, my name's Rich. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I'm from Claymont, Delaware, originally. It's always such an honor to be up here. I remember when I first moved here to Austin, Texas, I had about a year sober. And I got the honor of bringing a meeting out to the lodge. And I'm probably going to be all over the place tonight, but I hope I pass the message on to somebody. And Austin Recovery, even though I didn't come here, helped change my sobriety. You guys are in a good spot. I started going there when it was at Cross Park. Is there a Cross Park place any longer? Okay. But I've been out to this location a few times. So let's get into it. I grew up in a family that was middle upper class. We were definitely ill. My father was an alcoholic. He didn't claim to be an alcoholic, but I would guess he's an alcoholic. My mother and him stayed together until my father passed away at 50 years old. It was, for the most part, it was like a normal family, you know. My father worked all the time, but he always drank, and he got a couple DUIs and all that good stuff. But I remember as a kid just always trying to avoid my father, because I was always in trouble. I was always challenging authority. I knew I was different from the rest of the people around me from early on, from a very early age. I didn't feel like I fit in. I could get along with people, but there was just something that felt like it was missing. And I picked up my first drink at 5 years old. I had no clue what I was doing. All I know is I had taken sips from my mom's Bartles and James from time to time, and I snuck one of her wine coolers out of the fridge, and I pounded it like any alcoholic would. And I got a headache. And I couldn't sleep, and I remember my parents laughing at me and saying, I bet you he won't do that again. Little did they know, as I got older, that was going to happen a lot more. So I remember taking sips of my dad's beer, and I hated it. When I hit 14, was the first time that I experimented with marijuana, and I remember the feeling. Man, I was like walking on the clouds. It was like a feeling I had never had before. And all the way up to that point, when I was 14, I was constantly in trouble. I was always getting sent down to the principal's office. And it was just a constant battle. And this was the first time I could remember feeling like I was at one with the universe. Like, this is the way it's supposed to be all of the time. And But I remember running right to my friend's house and being like, hey, you got a spare change of clothes? I got to wash my clothes so my dad doesn't smell the weed. And I was just like paranoid and like planning around my father all the time just to make sure I didn't get caught. And that's the way the rest of my teenage years would go. I got brought home by the police on multiple occasions, never charged with anything. But they always told my parents I was going to end up in jail for sure. That I was going to be one of the criminals. I was going to be one of the bad kids. Because from day one, I was even challenging the police officers. I was yelling and screaming at them. I wasn't scared of them. I don't know if that's other people's experience, but there was something like I could not get across that you're in charge. You have a level of authority. I should show you respect. That didn't register for me. None of this stuff makes me an alcoholic or an addict. I'm just telling you that these are the behaviors I feel like led to my alcoholism and addiction. I remember all through my childhood going to my grandparents' house from 10 on every Friday night, I would dread it. I didn't want to be with my family because, one, my grandfather was the deacon that helped start the church that became a school that I now go to, and he was very good friends with the pastor. So I knew that my report card was coming due every single week with my grandfather, and I dreaded it. I dreaded it. It was always like, you did this wrong, and you did that wrong, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, on and on and on, and it felt like demeaning. I felt like I didn't want to even be around my family. I just didn't want to be there. And I didn't register the fact that my behavior was creating these problems. I didn't get that. I always thought I was a victim. I always thought if they just get off my back, everything would be just fine. Let me do it my way. And, man, that led to a lot of problems, as I got older, and I always did it my way. The problem is my way eventually leads to problems, jail, potentially death. And, at some point, which I'll get to, I couldn't do that any longer. So by the time I was a senior in high school, I only needed one credit. My dad held me back in 10th grade, and that backfired on him because I happened to go to a school that alternated years, and I took the right classes that fell in place with the schedule. So by my senior year, I only needed one credit, and I found that out. And so I realized all I needed to do was make sure I show up to one class. So I paid the security guard off with breakfast every morning to sign me in when I wanted to sign in. And I still somehow managed to fail that class. I don't know how that worked. So anyhow, the whole purpose of me going to school was to find out where the parties were on the weekend. I was already working 40 hours a week. I mowed lawns on the side. I mean, when you're drinking and partying like I am at 18 years old, you gotta have a resource to afford the drugs and alcohol that I wanted to consume. And so it was real tough to listen to teachers who were making less money than me tell me what to do. And that was my thought process. It's looking back on it, it's totally screwed up, but that was my thought process. So I'd show up to school, go to that one class. All right, where are the parties? Friday, Saturday, Sunday. By Thursday, I had the drugs and alcohol that I needed. The alcohol had to be tucked at a friend's house that was 20, like all this stuff that I'm managing, all of these things that I'm trying to organize and put into place. It was disastrous. I mean, those were the fun times though, honestly. Like those were the fun times. Like I wouldn't run my life into the ground if this stuff wasn't fun at some point. I don't know about you, but like there had to be that moment where like, or moments where like, this is where I belong, you know? And that's why I ran my life into the ground for it. So I figured, being an 18-year-old who just went to summer school and finally graduated high school, the good idea would be to join the United States Navy. All my friends thought I was crazy. They're like, you can't even follow instructions in school. How are you going to go to boot camp? How are you going to listen to these drill instructors? How are you going to do? I'm like, don't worry about it. I got it. I got this. Needless to say, I had a lot of problems in the Navy. I have people that I met here in Austin, Texas that know me because of boot camp. When I told him the story of what I had done in boot camp, he's like, I remember you, dude. Oh my God. So quick story. I don't want to shoot too far off, but anyway, you're not supposed to write in this little notebook unless it's for United States Navy purposes. And I happened to write notes back home on my free time in this notebook about every single drill instructor that I had interactions with. And they had F words, S words, B words, all the words you could possibly imagine. And there are 8 divisions in one building, and there's about 80 people in each division. And they read those notes over the loudspeaker because they saw it in my notebook. And they beat the hell out of me for 2 hours straight. I made a room sweat by myself. So anyhow, these are the type of things that my friends were warning me about, okay, that I shouldn't go into the military for. I was constantly in trouble. I couldn't follow instructions. I thought I knew better than a 270 or 240-year-old institution, and I was 18, 19 years old. The head drill instructor sat me down. He said, Fireman Hoff, you're about one of the smartest people I've ever met, but you're too smart for your own good. And he was, he was right. And for a while, I was too smart for this program. I thought I knew better than everybody else. I thought I knew better than the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, who had close to 100 years of success. Man, it's crazy just thinking back about how many opportunities I had to do the right thing. So anyhow, midway through the Navy, I had turned 21. I moved to upstate New York for my final training course. It was I was 1 year and 6 months into this education program. I chose to choose the hardest program that the Navy had to offer because I wanted to prove something to somebody. And the first time anyone ever talked to me about my alcoholism was at the end of this program. For two straight years, I had worked my butt off to prove everybody wrong. And that day was the day where they sat there and told me, "Fireman Hoff, we like you. You work hard. But we cannot have you run a nuclear reactor. You're not responsible enough." It's interesting when you can't show up on time, you can't iron your uniforms, and you can't do all the little things that they tell you what they take away from you and their opinion. But, you know, back then I looked at it as I was a victim. You know, they're taking everything away from me that I worked so hard for. And, you know, I look at it now, what, 15 years later, and I realize they probably did the best thing for me. And there'll be a little bit more in my story that will explain that. They then stripped me of a stripe for the second time because I had gone to captain's mass two times. Because I was constantly in trouble and constantly trying not to abide by the rules. And I decided at that point the U.S. Navy is not for me anymore because they won't let me do what I want to do. And I decided I'm going to need to find a way out of the military. And I at that time, there was don't ask, don't tell. And so I was like, I know, I'll tell them I'm gay. That'll work. And so I was like, yeah, what if they ask me to like prove it or something? I can't do that way. I know, I'll threaten to kill somebody. That'll work. And that was my bright plan. And so it did work. But it's absolutely insane, and I'm going to run through it with you real quick. What time do we go to, Chris? Just so I... Okay, 8:30. Perfect. So I left for 21 days without telling anyone where I was going. And the Navy paid me during that time. I don't know why, but they did. And I came back, and they were pissed. They were pretty pissed. And I'm wondering, what's the big deal? Why are you guys so mad? I'm back. I'm back before the 30 days. And this one, I'll never forget his name, Petty Officer Apple. He rode me for the next 3 days, and I said, that's it. That's my guy. That's who I'm going to threaten to kill. And so I did. I threatened. He got down on top of me again, and he was like 6'4", but he was like this toothpick. And I jumped right back in his face, and I said, "You put that finger in my face one more time, I'll break it off, and I'll break your neck." And I just go off. Just crazy, pure insanity. "You know what this means? Go talk to the chief." Chief sent me off. He said, "What are you doing, Fireman Hoff?" I said, "If you don't get me out of the military, I will kill somebody, probably Petty Officer Apple, and then I'll kill myself. Do you want two bodies on your conscience?" And I was dead serious. Like, I had bought into this idea of I was really going to do this. I don't think I'm capable of doing it, but, like, if I had to, I probably, like, I was at that level, like, of pure insanity. And mind you, during this whole time, I'm drinking every, I didn't even tell you this, I'm drinking every single day because I'm 21, I can do that, right? I mean, there was nights of blue Curacao. Do y'all know how that comes out the next day? It's bad. It's real bad. So anyway, this is what my life looks like right now. I'm constantly drinking, and if I'm not drinking, I'm driving as far away from base as possible. So this chief, he says, "You know what that means, right?" And I said, I think I do. He's like, "Well, you got to go to the psych ward." I was like, "Okay, let's go. I don't care." So I go to the psych ward. I keep real quiet. I'm watching everybody. There's a bunch of people acting crazy in there. And I get the round table meeting with the psychiatrists, and they're all like, "So what happened?" I said, "Well, I'm just telling you, if you send me back to the fleet and I don't have papers of dismissal of being in the Navy, I'm going to kill somebody." And they said, so wait, you're telling us that if we get you out of the military, that you're not going to hurt anyone. I said, that's absolutely right. And they said, okay, can you behave for 7 days? I said, if you promise me right here, right now, that I'm going to have those papers in hand 7 days from now, I won't hurt a single soul. I'll keep my mouth shut and I'll do whatever you tell me to do. They said, all right, no problem. Well, all these people that I had been observing in the psych office came up to me after the meeting because they know what that meeting is. They know that you're getting pretty much the final word at that meeting. And I said, yep, I'm getting out of the military. And they're like, no way. Like the dude that's bouncing the ball, not talking to anybody. The other person's like talking to themselves in the corner. They all of a sudden became real curious of how I got out of the military. So they were all obviously trying to hatch a plot of how to get out. And it was pretty interesting. And you know, those people, they were kind of my people. Like the few people that I did talk to, we got along real well. So maybe I'm just as crazy as them. I don't know. But either way, so process out. And for the next, I guess, 5 or 6 months, I'm at home. And me and my dad's relationship was real rocky my entire life. And I'm drinking. You know, I'm starting to use coke. I'm doing PCP, which I have you ever done a drug you hate? Oh, my God. So the first time I do PCP, I'm with my friends, right? And a couple of them didn't do it. And I was just so, like, angry. And I was like, okay, I like these people over here, but I want to go outside and hurt somebody. I don't know why. I just want to. And it was pure tunnel vision. I don't know. I don't know if y'all have done it or not. But it was, like, the weirdest, worst high ever. Some people like it. Some people like it. It's just not for me. But I knew at that point in time I wasn't ever going to do it again. Somehow I ended up doing it again. I don't know how that worked out. But, you know, maybe it was because it was like the only other thing available other than alcohol. So, you know, another bunch of weird cases with that. I tried Special K and crystal meth in the Navy for the first time. And crystal meth was, whoo, that was probably, and it was very hard to get in Delaware. But that was probably my favorite one I've ever done. I'm so thankful that I couldn't get my hands on that drug. So anyway, while getting out of the Navy, processing, waiting for the paperwork, for the next 6 months I'm sitting at home trying to find work, but I'm collecting this Navy check for the next 6 months. I'm still getting my pay. All my bills are getting paid. I'm living at home with my dad, and I'm actually for the first time building this relationship with my father that I never, ever had. Like, this is a man that, like, didn't really have any emotions. Like, it was like hard line. You obey the rules and that, and we'll get along and that's it. And I think at some point that kind of cracked at 18 years old when I decided to join the military. But even though I got out, there was still this level of respect. And I was worried about getting a bad discharge. I didn't really get a very bad one, but I got a not okay one. And I was told it would affect me for the rest of my life, and it hasn't, thankfully. But these moments were, like, so important to me. Because if I would have stayed in the Navy, I wouldn't have gotten that opportunity to spend that time with my dad, because he passed away 10 months after I got out of the military. And there was a lot of, like, mending and healing that happened during that time, even though I was drinking and using drugs and doing all that stuff. I really tried to keep it from him as best I could, and I think I did a pretty good job. But there was a relationship there, and there was, like, no regrets, you know? And you know, I know some people don't get that opportunity, and a lot of people don't get that opportunity before they get sober, but it was awesome. It's something I would never give up, and I remember the weekend before he passed away, I had gotten a job 3 months before, a job making more money than he was making. So he was proud, you know, and he said it. And he actually went and co-signed on a car with me, which is something that this man would never, ever do. Like, this is not who this man is. And I remember it was July 4th weekend, and, you know, we had a yearly thing with me and my friends, and we would all go out and we'd buy a crap load of fireworks. Sorry, I'm trying not to cuss. a crap load of fireworks, and we'd blow off like $5,000 worth of fireworks. Like, that's what we would do. And it was like a group of 15 or 16 of us. So, you know, we'd all throw in, you know, $200 or whatever, $300, whatever we had. And they kept calling me, and they're like, Rich, come up and shoot these fireworks off, man. We got beers up here, everything. I'm like, you know what? Guys, I'm going to have to miss it this year, you know? And I was hanging out with my dad that weekend, and we were drinking, smoking cigarettes, and we probably drank, I don't know, 15, 20 beers each. And we were just having a good old time, and I never, ever thought that moment would exist, and it did. This is not during sobriety again, you know, but it was an important moment for me. My father, I got the 90-day handshake from that company the following Monday, and I went home because my mom told me to check on my dad, and I found my father laying there dead. And, man, it was tough, you know, but I don't know if y'all have ever experienced this, but there was just like this emotional shutdown where nothing else existed. I couldn't feel anything. Even the cop came up to me and talked to me, and I'm like, dude, get the away from me. I don't want to talk to you right now. I was like, nothing bad happened here. Get out of my face, you know? And, for the next, I showed up to the funeral. I was so freaking drunk, but I was the one who did the eulogy, and I was taking pills and everything too. And I've been told I did a good job at the eulogy. I barely remember it at all. But I took over the family business, and for the next 6 months, I decided all it is going to be is work. And so I was going to DuPont, which is where I worked, and at night I was working at the business. And I brought the business back up, but you know what? I wasn't drinking, and I was freaking miserable. I wasn't drinking. I wasn't using drugs. I wasn't doing anything. So that was the thing that I would stand on for the next 6 or 7 years. See, I can stop when I want to. You see, I can do this when I want to. I have the power to do this. What you guys are telling me in these rooms has no bearing on me because I did this one time. You know, and I think that may be before I cross the line that the book talks about, you know. I don't know for sure. But I know that when I let go of that responsibility of that business, that game on. Game on. I was doing coke every weekend. Then it became I was doing it all through the week. I got in a relationship that went on and off for 3 years. And, man, I'm running a little bit low on time. I'm going to try to run through this pretty quick. But the common thread in my life was every time I get something good, it's getting yanked out from under me. I got all the way to the end of nuke school in the Navy, and it got yanked out from under me. I got back home, and I built this relationship with my father, and it got yanked out from under me. I'm the victim. Everybody's on top of me. Everyone's always picking on me, you know. And got in this relationship, and I fell in love with this girl. And we got engaged, and it was pretty crazy. I mean, it's hard to manage a relationship and drugs and alcohol. It really is. First time we had a major, major breakup, I was like, I know what I'll do. See, I always had these plans. Always had these plans. Here's another plan. I know what I'll do. I'll go to EAP at work, and I'll tell them I have a drinking problem. It'll resolve all my latenesses, you know, that I've had at work and all the problems I've had with my boss. And it'll get my girlfriend off my back because, you know, she wants me to get help. So now I look like the good guy. And it was my first introduction to AA. It wouldn't be my last. And that plan fell apart pretty quick. 3 months sober is what I got. I had decided I'm going to do 1, 3, and 12. And that's the answer right there. See, I'm not the type of guy that needs to do all the stuff that you do. I'm the guy that can figure this thing out on my own. Right. And, as you could probably imagine, that didn't work out very well. During that 3 months, I did get engaged to this girl. She got pregnant. We found out. We went to a wedding. And she lost the baby that night that we did the pregnancy test and all that stuff. And it was another moment where I was like, F you, God. I'm done. You know, I grew up in a Christian school and I was told God is this and God is that. I was like, you know what? God is nothing. God isn't anything. He keeps taking away all these good things from me. You know, what I didn't realize was it was my life and my plans that were taking all these good things away. I broke up with her. I stopped going to meetings. I stopped being involved at all. And within 2 months, I got my first DUI. I was like, oh shit, EAP is going to be on my back. I better just call him and tell him I did it and I'll get that off. You know, so I worked the system again to get out of trouble with work. And I mean, these people were paying me the whole time I was in treatment. I was 3 months long, outpatient. I mean, I abused so many systems. And I don't know. I still haven't made amends for those. I've made amends for many other things. I don't know how to make amends for those things. I know that there's going to be an opportunity to discuss that with these folks in the near future when I go home again. But these are still some lingering things that I need to deal with. But these were my plans. So I went to treatment again. I said, nah, that whole God thing, we don't need that. The 1 in 12 thing, we'll do that. Okay. And, you know, I played with it again. Within 1 month, I think it was like 3 weeks, I got my second DUI. You know, none of these things really make me an alcoholic. There's people out there that get DUIs, but they're not alcoholics. What makes me an alcoholic is that when I start, I can't stop. And when I'm stopped, I don't know when I'm going to start again. It's in the doctor's opinion, in a way better worded way than I put it. But it's that simple. It really is. If you find that you can't stop once you started, and then once you stop, you can't stay stopped, you might be an alcoholic. I suffer from a spiritual malady. There's nothing that will ever fill that spiritual malady like this program has for me. As you could imagine, I got laid off from that job. Well, I took a layoff from that job voluntarily with a severance package because I knew it was going to be gone anyway. You know, I knew about, it was a matter of time that job was going to be gone anyway. And in the midst of the next year, even my drug dealer, he was still kind of a friend. We actually hung out besides drugs. I don't know if that was a financial interest for him or not, but we actually hung out, and he actually said to me, he's like, hey, Rich, man, why do you drink like that? And for the first time in my life, I truly said at the core of my being, I said, you know why? Because I'm an alcoholic. That's why. And I know it. And for the next 2 to 3 months of my life, I'd watch everything unwind, everything fall apart. My second introduction was a fake introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't really partake. But this time, I was out drinking late one night. I had Adderall, Soma, Percocet, what's the thing called? Suboxone, and alcohol in my system. I blacked out that night. I woke up at 11 a.m. The dogs had gotten out, and the last time they had gotten out on a highway. It's called I-95 on the East Coast, quite similar to I-35. And so that's where I went, and I wasn't paying attention. I was still drunk from the night before, very hazy. A semi-tractor trailer stopped in the middle of the road. I swerved off the road, flipped the car twice, somehow landed on the wheels into oncoming traffic of a parallel highway. With oncoming traffic coming one way. Now, I don't know this from memory. I know this from witnesses that saw what happened. And so what I was told was I jumped out of the car immediately, and I saw pictures of the vehicle. There's no reason why I should be alive today. And I started walking, and I walked a mile, got on the phone, and I called a friend of mine. I said, come pick me up. And by the time he had gotten to me, there were 6 police officers that had surrounded us. And the adrenaline had wore off, and I fell to my knees because I felt so weak. The only thing that happened to me, and you know, all I can think is there must have been a higher power looking out for me, because when I saw that vehicle, it was completely crushed in from the top. I know for a fact I wasn't wearing my seatbelt. And all four tires were flat. Everything was destroyed. And I told the cops, I said, you got to bring me to the hospital. And I went to the hospital, and they're pumping me full of liquids. And I'm now getting charged with my third DUI. And because they took blood while they were at the hospital. And they cut all my clothes off me. I was in a gown. And, I guess my friends told my mom where I was. And my mom walked in, and some of y'all might relate to this, and the look on her face, I can't explain it any better than this, but the look on her face was immediate relief followed immediately by disgust, because she was so sick and tired of watching me destroy my life. And I heard all my life, this, you have so much potential, why don't you do this and why don't you do that? And for the first time, I was willing to listen to somebody with open ears and take some suggestions from some folks in AA. I said, you know what? I'm going to give this thing 1 year. And I'm going to do whatever these people tell me that I need to do. And if my life is better at that point, I'm going to give it one more year. And I'm going to do it as fast as I possibly can. So I went immediately to treatment. I got in. I still had insurance with that company I got laid off from. And they paid like 80% of it, which is crazy. I got into fights there. I was still trying to run things my own way. I got set up with one of the premier outpatient places to go, the Lyman House in Delaware. And I decided the day that I got out, I'm going to call my brother and I'm going to tell him to come pick me up so we can go play some golf before I got to go into this outpatient treatment center. And I did all that, and I grabbed the stuff that I needed for the treatment center. It wasn't really a treatment center. It was like a sober house, but it was like super, super strict rules. Like, you're all rolling together. You got house managers and you're under all types of curfews, and you got all types of regulations. But it was the premier place to be, so that's where I belong, I showed up at about 6:30 p.m., and they said, where were you? I said, what do you mean, where was I? I'm here on time. And they said, yeah, we showed up with a van to come pick you up. You knew we were coming. Why did you leave before we got there? And I said, I don't know. I just wanted to go see my friends before I came in, and I just wanted to see my brother. And they're like, come back tomorrow. Call us before you come. And I just showed up with a trash bag full of clothes and was like, hey, what's up, guys? You gonna let me in? How are you doing? All happy-go-lucky. I'm sober 30 days. Yeah, I'm doing this right. And they said, man, he came up to me and hugged me. I'll never forget his name. His name's Clint. As far as I know, he's still there. He said, I'm sorry, bud, but we can't let you in. I don't think you've hit bottom yet. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. What is the deal? What's going on? And, I went back to a friend of mine, family friend of mine, and I said, please let me stay with you until I find another place to go. Please let me stay. He said, you got 3 days. Went to the Salvation Army. They accepted me in. I didn't like their rules. By 19 days, I was kicked out. This is sober, folks. This is what I was doing sober. I mean, I was challenging authority in these treatment centers. The same people that I was asking for help, I was challenging them. And I remember when I got kicked out, I walked 5 miles in 95 degrees heat. And if you're from Delaware, that's hot. Okay? We're not used to this 105 degrees heat you guys got out here. I've grown accustomed to it. I've been here long enough. But my first year here was pretty rough. So anyhow, I got about 10 minutes left. I'm going to try to wrap this up. And I prayed to God. I rented a hotel room. I had enough money to rent a hotel room that night. And I prayed to God. I said, God, all right, I'll do whatever you need. I'll do whatever you want. I need your help. It was the first time that I actually prayed and asked for God's help. And within 24 hours, an old friend of mine called me and he said, hey, man, how's it going? I said, man, it's not going well. He said, why not? I said, I don't got a place to live, man. I'm pretty much homeless. He said, man, do you remember the time when we were out of a place and we didn't have any work, you let us stay with us? You can come stay with us anytime you want, as long as you need. I don't know where that phone call came from, I know I didn't deserve it. All I know is I prayed and asked for help that night. My eyes were opened. And within a couple of weeks, I had started hanging out with some guys that I saw that were bouncing around together to all these different meetings. And one of them introduced me to my first sponsor. And it's amazing what people in AA do. God. We sat down and he talked to me about the first three steps. We were there together for about 2 hours after that first meeting I went to with him. I'm sorry. I met him at a meeting, the second meeting I saw him at. He said, all right, here's your fourth step. It's outlined in the book. How long do you think it's going to take you to do it? I was like, I don't know. He's like, you think you can get it done in a week? I said, I guess so. I guess I will. And like any good alcoholic, I waited until about 12 hours before the project was due to do it. You know, there's something amazing about grace, though. You know, when I did that work, there was something that happened. You know, I did it in a way that I didn't think about it. And I wrote down things. Man, when I read that four step, I'm like, why in the hell would I write this down? I don't want to tell anybody this stuff. But there's a magic that happens. I don't know how to explain it. It's magic. And that man picked me up. I don't remember if it was a Wednesday night or a Thursday night or whatever. He had gotten off of work. He brought me to a meeting. He brought me to dinner, which I refused to let him pay for. I don't know why. Whatever. It was a pride thing, I guess. And so we went to the meeting. We ate dinner. We went to his house. And by about 9 p.m., we started doing a fifth step. And we stayed up all the way to about 3 a.m. He's like, all right, you got anything else you want to let off your chest? And I was like, man, I don't think so. I think I shared everything else. You know, I feel like I shared everything at that time. There was things that came to me later, which find out you don't have to worry about it. If it's not popping up now, it'll come to you later when your brain starts getting together and you can talk about it later. You know, but I threw my heart on those papers and we talked about it. And that man went and took like a 45-minute nap and dropped me off at home before he had to go to work. He didn't even sleep. And even though I didn't sleep very much, for the next day and a half, I couldn't sleep. It's not because I was, like, high or anything, but I felt high. I felt light. All that shit, all that stuff was off my shoulders. I wasn't carrying those secrets anymore. It was like this new thing, man. I don't even know how to explain it, but it was one of the most freeing moments I've ever had in my entire life. And from there, we talked about seven the next time we met, and he said, all right, I want you to write out all the amends you owe. He's like, it's already on your paper. It's already what you wrote down. It's no big deal. It shouldn't take you very much time. I want you to do three amends. And by the time, it only took me like a month to get through this process because I was so freaking willing to see a change in my life that I was willing to do whatever it took. You know, and for the next, I'd say 8 months or so, I was doing everything I was told. I went to this outpatient treatment, even though I freaking hated it. And I was studying the big book, and I was going to meetings, and I was doing all the things y'all told me to do. I didn't do step 12 until I got here to Texas. And I got about 5 minutes left. I'm trying to wrap all this stuff up because there's so much cool stuff that's happened since then. He got me to the 12th step, and I had this plan to get out to Texas, but I didn't want to come to Texas. I wanted to stay in Delaware. That was my plan. And I started opening up to the idea that maybe this is where God's leading me. And I don't know if he still comes out here or not, but Charlie P. Was the number that was given to me. And I called him immediately because that's what a good friend of mine in AA told me to do. And man. You know, you meet people along the way that just really turn your life around in this program. You just got to stick around and do the work long enough to see them. And he was one of those people, and so was his wife, Katie. And Katie sat me down about a month of hanging out with Charlie and the guys, and she said, Rich, how long you been sober? And I'm like, I don't know, like a year and a half. And she's like, how many guys you sponsoring? And I'm like, well, none. What are they? My my brother-in-law gave me this beat work truck that has like tape for seats and no air conditioning. And like, who wants what I have? You know, I don't even have a job. Like, who wants that? Right? Like, who wants that life? She said something to me. Well, first she said, you can't hang out with these boys if you don't do what these boys do, because that's what we do. We go out and help others. And I was like, who does this lady think she is? Talking to me like that. She's crazy. And she's like, but you know what? The bottom line is, have you had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps? And I said, yeah, my life's different. I'm happy. My life's good compared to what it was. And she's like, well, then you need to go out and give that to somebody else, because you can't keep doing this way. And you know what? I don't know about you guys, but those are the type of people I need in my life that shake me up hard enough, but they do it in a caring way to make me change the direction that I'm going. Because I don't listen to anybody else. I don't listen to people that are like, oh, honey, you know, this is what you got to do. No, I need those people in my life. Because people that care about me are willing to step on my toes to let me know that I need to do something different. And that is what happened to me, because before, when I was in AA, I didn't accept anybody talking to me all types of crazy, telling me what I got to do. I refused to hear them, but AA taught me that maybe these people have a general idea of what I need to be doing with my life. Within a month, I had been asked by Will Miley at Austin Recovery. He was a director, so y'all know his last name. Anyway, at Cross Park, to start a meeting at the lodge, and I started this meeting, and I had no clue what I was doing, and I didn't want to do it, and no service commitment that I've ever done since I've been sober did I ever want to do. I never wanted to do them, but they've been some of the most rewarding experiences of my entire life. And for years after I would do that meeting, I did that meeting for a year and a half every single week, no matter what. I told work, this is the day that I have off. I don't care. This is the day that I have off. This is when I'm going. And they knew I was an AA. I'm not saying that's necessarily a good idea. All I'm saying is, for me, in my experience, a lot of people respect that. And I'm not afraid to admit it to people. I don't care if you know I'm an AA. I don't. You know? Because it's what saved my life. And when you have that feeling about something, you don't care who knows. I've met more people along the way. And during those next couple years, I had guys coming up to me that I didn't even recognize anymore. It talks about it in the book. A man came to me that I seemed to know, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it, who he was. I've seen y'all come out of Austin Recovery that I had brought that meeting to and said, man, your meeting helped change my life. You want to talk about something that gives you meaning and purpose? Have somebody come tell you that. And it completely changed the direction of my life, and it completely changed my thought process in these rooms in AA. It's nothing that I did. All I did was show up where God told me to show up. I didn't do anything, and I didn't even want to be there. I didn't even want to be there. And I remember we got to the point where we were bringing 12 guys out to this treatment center, and we'd go out to dinner afterwards, and we're all like, man, that's the best feeling in the world. We're getting to help people. That's not the guy that walked into rooms in AA. I wanted to know how I could help me, and that's all I cared about. And we were all on a high together, a spiritual high. You know, since then, I got an opportunity with my current sponsor, Solis, that I didn't want to do either. He said to me, he said, you know, if you want me to sponsor, you're going to have to take on a service commitment, and I just so happen to be taking on one right now, and we're starting the Capital of Texas Conference. I said, I don't want to do a conference. He said, well, you don't want to be sponsored by me then. I said, okay, I guess I'm doing the conference. And, you know, these are the people that changed my life. And, you know, I got the opportunity to help build something that currently exists and is still going on today. As a matter of fact, it's happening in August. And if y'all are getting out of here, I suggest you go to it. It's an awesome conference. There's speakers coming from all over the country that have experience, strength, and hope that will blow your mind. Way better than what I'm doing here tonight. You know, it was one of the most rewarding experiences in my life. I worked my butt off at that conference, and I worked so hard during that weekend that it kind of just flew by. But there was instances where I got to sit back and be like, man, we built this from the ground up because God asked us to, and look what he's done. Look what he's done. All these people, there were 700 and some people the first year. That's unheard of. There's conferences in the United States that don't even hit 200. The recovery community here in Austin is strong. Y'all are in the right place. I'm telling you, this place is awesome. The recovery I've learned here, and I'm not going to compare in a bad way. I'm just saying, like, it opened my eyes so much more than it did in Delaware. I don't know if it's still, you know, I don't know if it was the place I was in or what. All I know is this is a badass place to be. You know, when you get dragged in, when you do a good job, you get dragged into new things in sobriety, and you always get asked to do things you don't want to do. And I currently got asked to do Citywide, and I was like, man, I called Solis again. I said, Solis, man, it's a sinking ship, dude. I don't want to be a part of it. I don't want to be the one that brings it down. And for 6 months, I was an assistant coordinator. And then now I'm currently the event coordinator. And if y'all show up there, you'll see me at the podium for about 4 minutes telling you what's going on with Citywide. And it's been an amazing experience. I've watched this enthusiasm boil up inside of this group. And all the service positions are filled. Financially, we're in a good position. We're looking at donating to the service structure again, which we haven't done in 4 years. And this is something else that I didn't want to do. All I'm saying to y'all is when you get out of here and somebody in the, I don't care what rooms you go to, if you go to NA, CA, AA, doesn't matter, whatever A you choose to go to, if somebody that's living a good life is telling you to do something and you don't want to do it, and it's for the benefit of the program, you probably should. You know, if it's for their benefit, they're probably one of those creepy people that are in the rooms, because we all know they exist. Man, all I can say is I continue to give back as much as I can, and my life looks amazing today. I don't belong up here. I'm not this guy. This is not who I was. When I walked in these rooms, I was sitting on a bus stop and the lady told me, "You're homeless, bro. You think you got options?" I didn't have options, man. God provided these options for me. The rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous has provided these options for me. And opportunities like this have provided these options for me. And my life is way more amazing than I ever thought it would be. My first sponsor told me, he said, if you write it down on paper, I promise you, in 2 or 3 years, you'll be robbing yourself. And all I wanted when I came into these rooms was to have a job making 50 grand a year and have my car back. That's all I cared about. I'm well exceeded it. I would have robbed myself so much money, so many opportunities to help people. All the good, positive material things that I have. Material things just don't mean nothing. They mean nothing because I've had them before. What I have today that's different is I have a spiritual way of living that gives me all of these things. And all I do is continue to give back as much as I can. I can't thank y'all enough for letting me be out here. Thank you so much.